I'd like to begin with a poem by Morgan Farley titled Clearing. I am clearing a space here where the trees stand back. I am making a circle so open the moon will fall in love and stroke these grasses with her silver. I am setting stones in the four directions, stones that have called my name from mountaintops and riverbeds, canyons and mesas. Here I will stand with my hands empty, mind empty under the moon. And if something takes my life, if a sudden wind sweeps through me, changing everything, I will not resist. I am ready for whatever comes. But I think it will be something small. An animal padding out from the shadows on delicate paws. Or a word spoken so softly, I hear it inside. There is a way to live that makes the angels cry out in rapture. There is a way to live that makes each cell a star. Come, stand with me here. It is cold, I know, and silent. Nothing is happening. The next breath and the next is the new life. How do we clear a space for the dark? How do we enter into that which we are offered by this time of year? By winter, by Advent, by solstice and Christmas and Hanukkah and all the other seasonal observances, each with their own wisdom, that have come down to us through the millennia. A few years ago, I came up with the idea of marking this time of year in part by hanging strings of small white lights around the inside of the waiting room in my old psychotherapy office. Now, this waiting room was quite large, 400 square feet, picture 20 by 20. But the colleague with whom I shared this office was open to my idea, so one afternoon he brought in his stepladder, and we spent a few hours hanging those little plastic 3M hooks up around at even intervals across the room, and then we strung the lights so that they hung from the ceiling against the wall in graceful looping arches all around the perimeter. My idea was to then turn off the floor lamps that we normally used to light the waiting room and to let those small white holiday lights take over that job for a few weeks. I turned off those lamps, and my colleague, looking around the now dimly lit room, wasn't so sure. He said, "It's a little dark." And he was right. It was indeed quite a bit darker than normal. And that was exactly how I had intended it to be. For untold thousands of years before the prevalence of artificial light, from campfires to the energy-efficient LED light bulb, part of the collective experience of the deepening of winter was experiencing the deepening dark that came with it. and I wanted the relative seasonal dark of our waiting room to reflect those ancient rhythms, to evoke those ancient feelings, to stir those ancient reflections. I wanted to make it a fitting transitional space, a place where people could come in from the hectic, noisy, blazingly lit outer world and experience a few moments of contemplative quiet and something a little darker, something akin to candlelight or firelight. My instincts, it turns out, were good ones, because such moments, it seems, are indeed becoming increasingly rare. I was reminded of this a few years ago on the Sunday before Thanksgiving, when I pulled the Pacific Northwest magazine from my Sunday Seattle Times and saw the cover headline, which read, "Blinded by the light, wrapped in an earthly glow, we're missing the wonder of the stars." The article was about the impact of light pollution, about the absence of true darkness due to the ways that artificial light has filled the night sky, especially in Europe and North America. The article points out that 99% of Americans never routinely see a truly dark sky. The implications of this, the article suggests, are profound. The article quotes a man named Dave Ingram, who calls himself a guerrilla astronomer. This means he sets up his telescope in an unlikely place, the parking lot of the Albertsons on 208th Street in Kent. He then invites those passing by to stop and take a look. "The current bunch of us," Ingram says, "will be the first in the history of the planet to go most or all of the way through life, failing to grasp our place in the universe because we simply have never seen it." He continues, "Put anybody out under the stars for 30 minutes, and they begin to start asking the big questions." Put anybody out under the stars for 30 minutes, and they begin to start asking the big questions. The article then quotes Paul Bogart, an English professor at James Madison University, and he picks up where Ingram leaves off. Bogart says that allowing there to be enough darkness to see the night sky is about humility and perspective. It's pretty easy, he says, if you never see the universe, to think this world is all there is. If you really see the night sky, you can't help but evoke feelings of wonder and awe and gratitude and spirituality. Now, that may sound like nothing but a lovely poetic sentiment, but it turns out our lack of entering into the experience of true darkness comes with real consequences on a number of levels. The article cites research suggesting that there may be links between perpetual light exposure and interruptions of the body's natural hormonal cycles, and that this may contribute to depression and other maladies. One study showed a doubling of breast cancer risk among women who work night shifts and suffer likely hormonal imbalances caused by interruptions in exposure to natural rhythms of light and darkness. In other words, when we focus solely on the light, when we disconnect ourselves from the dark, when we repress the wisdom of the sacred feminine, and make it subject to the unnatural schedules and production-driven agendas of the patriarchy, we double the risk of disease, of dis-ease. And we increase the risk of literal cancer and cancer of the soul. And so we see how important it is to have an intentional, conscious, even reverent relationship with the dark, and why we must allow it to reach us, to open us, to teach us. I want to suggest that it is the absence of this kind of relationship to the dark that gives rise to other kinds of darkness. The kinds that are always there, but that seem to have become more visible, more empowered, and more troubling before, during, and since the recent election. I find myself wondering, what would happen if we put President-elect Trump out under the stars for 30 minutes? And what might we learn by reflecting on that imagined possibility? I don't know him personally, and I think it's important to stay humble and open in the face of the mystery of any other human being. So, of course, I can't say for sure what would happen. But I find that two possibilities present themselves to my imagination. The first is that he simply would not be able to bear it and would look for some way to leave. Unable to tolerate the quieting, calming, centering effects of the sacred dark, he would start to rant or bluster or tweet, and would in short order get up, leave, and return to the bright lights of the ivory tower that bears his name. In this scenario, he would be, I think, an archetype, a living, breathing exemplar of a world that suffers from perpetual light exposure. Think about it. Relentlessly craving the limelight, attention, praise, demonstrating an almost complete inability to acknowledge any flaw or error or wrongdoing, manifesting an inability to speak or act from the place of humility that Paul Bogart spoke of. Someone who suffers from failing to grasp our place in the universe. An inability to bear the darkness, to receive its gifts, its wisdom, leads, among other things, to something called projection, a term we psychotherapists use to describe the dangerous phenomenon of taking the unacknowledged, unconscious, unintegrated parts of one's self and putting it out there, projecting it, attributing it to the other, to other individuals or communities. Unable to acknowledge or process or heal one's own pain or woundedness or flaws, we come to see them instead only in a distorted perception of the other. We engage in the inevitably futile attempt to banish all that projected pain, to put it out beyond our own borders, and then to build a wall to keep it from coming back. It's the same principle we find in the Old Testament idea of the scapegoat. This is from the book of Leviticus. My Old Testament stands. Then Aaron shall lay both his hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it all the iniquities of the people of Israel and all their transgressions and all their sins, putting them on the head of the goat and sending it away into the wilderness. Sound familiar? So how do we withdraw our projections? How do we take back our own pain instead of unconsciously inflicting it on other people and other communities? One answer is suggested by the second possible response I imagine that President-elect Trump might have if we put him out under the stars for 30 minutes. I imagine he might begin to cry, to weep. The poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow once wrote, "If we could read the secret history of even our worst enemies, we would find in each of them sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility." I find myself wondering about the sorrow and suffering in President-elect Trump and of those who follow in his wake. I find myself wondering, what has he been through? What deep, painful, wounding experiences has he had that would lead him to speak with such insensitivity, with such defensiveness, with such disdain, to manifest callowness, callousness, instead of compassion, bravado instead of bravery? And how is he, again, a mirror of the unaddressed sorrows and sufferings and pain and woundedness of so many in this world? And of the ways that individuals and community act out their pain rather than working it out. There's an old Yiddish proverb, "After a good cry, your heart is lighter." And so I imagine President-elect Trump and each of us out under the stars for 30 minutes, brought first through the healing portal of a good cry. And then, with our hearts lighter, freed from the distorting influences of the weight of our grief, we might regain a sense of our place in the universe. And from that place, reclaim our capacities for wonder and awe, for humility and blessing, for compassion and courage, for gratitude and grace. Such moments of authentic encounter with the dark are, I think, essential in providing the foundation, the grounding, the center of stillness, and the fierce courage from which we can stay both vigilant and active, standing up to evils like racism and misogyny and homophobia and xenophobia, and putting into practice our core values of tolerance and welcome, of caring and creation, of peace and justice, of equality and equanimity. Sometime back, as part of my other vocation as a performing musician and singer and songwriter, I wrote a song titled "My Spring is Autumn," which begins like this. "My spring is autumn, when the world turns gold. I'm warming up just as the days grow colder. I'm rising as the leaves begin to fall. The days are shorter, but I'm standing taller." Now, the second verse speaks even more directly to our theme here this morning. "My day is night. I like the darker view. My eyes adjust and midnight shines on through. By moon and starlight is when I can see more of the detail in the mystery." There is, I think, a connection between that mystery and the archetype of the alchemist, which the Seattle Unity community has been reflecting on this month of November. The roots of the word alchemy mean simply the power or process of transforming something ordinary into something precious. How might we inhabit the archetype of the alchemist in our daily lives? How do we enter into and travel through the dark? How do we accept Morgan Farley's example and invitation? Here I will stand with my hands empty, mind empty under the moon. Come, stand with me here. It is cold and silent, I know. I'd like to suggest two simple, ordinary, concrete ways we might enter the dark, travel through it, and receive its gifts. First, once a day, as winter darkens in the quiet of your own home, turn off all the lights, not just the lamps, but the screens and even the LED indicators. For me, it's the bright blue clock on my coffee maker. Sit in the dark for a few moments. Try to perceive and receive its wisdom. And then light a single candle and sit for a minute or three or five. Drink in that flame, that light, that spark. Second, go out into the actual dark. Once or twice a week, over the next month or two, put on your hat and coat and mittens and scarf and go out and stand under the night sky where it actually is cold and silent, where nothing is happening. There, be still. Breathe. Feel. Wait. Give yourself at least a small glimpse of what our ancestors experienced so deeply for thousands and thousands of years. There you may experience the echoes of what the wise men, the magi, did so long ago. There you may experience something of the title of the workshop I'll be doing on Wednesday night. They followed a star, astrology and Christianity as allies on the journey. Now, let's face it, those two wisdom traditions down through the millennia have not always worked and played well with each other. But it turns out they not only have a lot in common, they are actually about the same thing. And that's what we'll be exploring on Wednesday night. But again, there under the night sky, you may remember what the poet Joyce Rupp once wrote. There was a time before maps when pilgrims traveled by the stars. It is time for the pilgrim in me to travel in the dark, to learn to read the stars that shine in my soul. I will walk deeper into the dark of my night. I will wait for the stars, trust their guidance, and let their light be enough for me. Blessings.
Table. He also has an email list that you can sign up, which is also at the program table.